Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week we look at the Birmingham pub bombs, but actually comparing them to what happened just the month afterwards here in Bristol, where two were injured and nobody was killed. In Birmingham, on the 21st of November 1974, 182 people were injured and 21 killed. Chris Hewitt was a reporter on the Coventry Journal at the time and had his own ideas about what really happened up in Birmingham. Also, Alan Cheshire from Sunny Cleethorpes up in Lincolnshire. He was with the army in Bosnia, where he had rather a rough time. And he has a lot of opinions about the British Army in Afghanistan, which he believes has been a disaster. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm Chris Hewitt. I've been a journalist for 45 years. And I used to work on the independent Coventry Journal in the early 1970s.
On the 21st of November 1974, there was a series of bombs in Birmingham pubs, am I right?
There were two bombs that went off.
21 people were killed and 182 people injured. The context of this, of course, was the mainland bombing campaign by the Irish Republican Army, which is really, I suppose, the 1970s and 80s version version of a long struggle that there's been really for emancipation of the nationalist community in Ireland in the face of an army occupation in the north of Ireland.
Well, army occupation is one way of looking at it. If the army wasn't there, you'd probably have even more trouble. This is what I believe is the truth. There was an active provisional IRA cell that was being hunted by Special Branch. On the night in question, they actually planted three bombs, not two. Two went off, the third one at Selly Oak did not. But the third one was planted after most of the six had been arrested. Therefore, they couldn't have planted it. Right?
What about warnings? Because the IRA normally would give warnings. They didn't they realised that there was a lot of bad propaganda or bad press they'd get from if they were to kill innocent people.
Well, the provisional, you must remember it's the provisional IRA, not the official. The Provisional was a very professional organisation. They changed their structure from the old brigade to four-man cells plus a quartermaster. The quartermaster went round to find telephone boxes to give the warning to. When the bombs were actually planted, both telephone boxes had been vandalised. So the quartermaster would go and find another one that was working before he could make his warning phone calls to the police and the Birmingham Post and Mail.
And they used to use recognised code names, didn't they?
That's correct, yes.
So what went wrong?
Well, first of all, the bombs weren't supposed to go off. Because the telephone boxes that had been identified for telephoning through the warnings had been vandalised, the warnings didn't get through until it was too late. The police then started looking at people who supported the Republican movement. Well, that's the reason these six were arrested.
Hang on, because at the moment, you see, what you've said originally that the police special branch were already following a cell, so surely they should have arrested this cell.
Well, that's one of the great mysteries. Special branch were within 48 hours of arresting the five people actually responsible. The case was taken off them and given to the controversial Serious Crime Squad under Superintendent George Reed. The Serious Crime Squad were nicknamed the Lying Squad because of the number of people they'd fitted up.
Why were they fitting people up, Chris?
Because that's one of the great mysteries. We think they just wanted to get a good arrest rate for promotion purposes. But there were a hell of a lot of appeals as a result of convictions that they'd secured.
Okay, so West Midlands Police took over and arrested a lot of individuals they believed were responsible for these pub bombings.
These were people who supported the United Ireland, but they were not. But none of the people were no members of any of the paramilitaries.
And you said that the arrests took place after one of the bombs had planted. How can you prove that?
Well, the third bomb was planted after arrests had been made. Because the people were arrested they were going on the boat train to Holyhead, and they were arrested at Holyhead Station. So they couldn't get from Holyhead to Selly Oak in 5 minutes, could they?
So, I mean, there are millions of supporters of a United Ireland. How come these six individuals were arrested?
Well, probably because they'd been... because they'd made donations and they'd never made any secret of their views. But, you see, if the Serious Crime Squad had read Special Branch's files, they'd have known who to arrest. They'd arrested the five people actually responsible.
So what's your theory about why the wrong people were arrested?
The formation of the West Midlands Police was not very popular with the rest of the West Midlands, apart from Birmingham. And they were desperate to prove that this reorganisation worked. That's why they... See, if you look at all the major miscarriages of justices, they're all down to the what's called the reorganised police forces, like West Midlands, South Wales, Greater Manchester.
I mean, the end result was that six, now called the Birmingham Six, that's Hugh Callaghan, Patrick Joseph Hill, Gerard Hunter, Richard McKill Kenny, William Power and John Walker, all did 17 or 16 years in prison.
That's right.
They were given life sentences in 1975 for these bombings, and then in the Court of Appeal, the entire case was overturned and they were released in 1991. Now, this ended up being one of the greatest ever miscarriages of justice in Britain, particularly because there were so many people that were, I mean, some might say, fitted up, Chris. So can you just take us through, you know, what you think it should be the... I mean, because obviously that's a long time, 17 years, where the wrong story has been peddled around as to who did it. What really happened?
Well, what really happened was that the four-man provisional IRA cell and quartermaster planted the bombs because they wanted, and the aim was that the authorities are going to be tipped off so that they didn't explode, right? It was obviously to put pressure on the British government to work for United Ireland.
I mean, do you mean nobody was killed or that the bombs didn't explode?
The bombs were never intended to go off because it was all timed so that the police would get there and get, you know, the bomb disposal people would get there and disarm the bombs.
I mean, how that can take possibly hours to defuse a bomb. I mean, it's a very dangerous thing to do. Surely, Surely the IRA cell could, find another phone box within that amount of time in order to give a warning, at least to make sure that the building was cleared.
Well, by the time they found a phone that worked, that hadn't been vandalised, it was too late. Because the warning got through, and then the bombs went off shortly afterwards.
Okay, so who should be still possibly brought to book, if anybody, for this?
Well, the five people involved, three of which are dead.
So do we know who they were?
The police do. All five were given letters of immunity from prosecution under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement.
I mean, how has this gone down amongst the families of the victims in Birmingham?
Well, a lot of the families, I don't think the families have been told about this.
So how come you know and they don't?
Well, because 3 days afterwards, at about 2:05, I was walking past Coventry's police station and a group of coppers who were just knocking off duty knew I was a working journalist and called me over and told me the Serious Crime Squad had arrested the wrong people. And the suggestion was I should look for the third bomb because the third bomb was planted after these people were in custody, so they couldn't have done it. Then, worst of all, the five people actually responsible flew out from Birmingham Airport on the morning of the third day, dressed as businessmen. They then went to European airports that had direct Aer Lingus flights with the Republic. Because obviously the Aer Lingus and the Irish government, the Republic's government, would never cooperate with the request for extradition on what anything they regard as a political crime. Now, one of the cell was then rushed in front of the Provisional IRA Council, asked what the hell went wrong, because the bombs weren't supposed to go off, right? And incidentally, a lot of my information has actually come from coppers who were not listened to by the Serious Crime Squad or the top brass at the time.
Okay, so what was the reaction from the IRA Army Council to this disastrous operation?
Well, they played it low key. They obviously were never going to admit that that it was a mistake, and they didn't, and they never admitted that the police had got the wrong people.
They
never said, well, we have the five people and they're actually responsible and they're safe in the Irish Republic. They could have said that, you see, which they didn't.
It does sound very difficult to believe that the police would know who'd done it, Chris, and yet not arrest them.
Well, because the case was taken off Special Branch and given to the Serious Crime Squad. Now, if Special Branch had kept it, those people would have been arrested before they flew out the country.
Who did that and why?
Well, that's what nobody will ever find out. I actually interviewed the Chief Constable of the West Midlands, Sir Philip Knight, in May 1984, and I actually put him on the spot over this, and he wouldn't give an answer. All he would say was, I've read the evidence, and it's an overwhelming case.
What did he mean by that?
Well, he believed that he said the evidence was so good that the convictions would never be overturned on appeal.
Which they were.
On the second appeal, yes.
Okay, so it took two appeals. The other thing, of course, is that there was a World in Action programme which looked at this. Were you involved in that? Because that made a big difference.
It did, mate, but they did not contact me. Had they done so, I would have given them the information that 3 days afterwards, a group of coppers had told me the Serious Crime Squad had arrested the wrong people.
But, I mean, we've got the relatives of 21 people killed, 182 injured in that attack. Yeah. They, of course, are sitting there thinking, well, if the people who were arrested and did 17 years in prison for the death of our loved ones or the injury didn't do it, who did?
They were named at the new inquest that was held in Birmingham. Now, again, I applied to the Home Office to be allowed to give evidence, and I've never even had a thanks, but no thanks.
So what, you mean they just ignored you?
Yeah. Now, when the Birmingham Six were released, there was an investigation into the conduct of the Serious Crime Squad. I was interviewed by two detectives from another part of the West Midlands Force, and I confirmed that in the case of any members being charged for conspiracy to purge, to pervert the course of justice, I'd be happy to give evidence on what I told them. The case was set for Oxford Crown Court. Then, the last moment, the case was dropped.
Why?
We've never been told. Because my understanding is that I wasn't the only one who knew what was going on.
So what do you take from all this, Chris, as a sort of lesson from this whole process?
Well, ultimately, it's the senior civil servants in the Home Office who interfered in the affairs of West Midlands Police to try and get convictions at any cost to show their pet project worked.
And what about lessons for journalists today? Because we don't really see much scrutiny. There's also, a lot of terrorism going on, Chris, now.
There has
been since the 7/7 bombings. I mean, obviously, if something so horrendous can happen back in 1975 with this miscarriage of justice, what do you make of the current state of journalism and the criminal justice system with modern terrorism?
Well, if you're talking about the terrorism then, there was a tendency for big papers to believe what the police had told them. I mean, well, now, the main papers in Birmingham were owned by Lord Iliffe, who is, they're now owned by the Mirror Group, or Reach, as it's called. Now, until the Post and Mail was sold to somebody called Ralph Ingersoll, they always took the police line. Now, when Ralph Ingersoll bought the papers, he appointed Chris Oakley from the Liverpool papers to be the managing director and editor-in-chief. And Chris took a much different view, and you immediately saw that they were a lot more questioning about what the West Midlands police had been up to, which I might add didn't make him very popular. The big problem we got today is we haven't got half the staff necessary to cover courts. I mean, if you're going back, when I was a junior reporter, the Coventry Evening Telegraph had 100 journalists. I think it's got 12. Birmingham Post and Mail, and the Sunday Mercury and the Sports Argus, I think they had over 300 journalists. That's why they were damn good papers, because, you know, there wasn't... But they were far less willing to criticise the police. And I think a lot of the crime journalists were too closely involved in police social affairs. You know, I mean, the crime editor on the Birmingham Post regularly used to go to police booze-ups, which I think, you know, there's a clear conflict of interest. But you're absolutely right.
Oh, hang on, because he could pick up some good stories there, maybe.
Well, if he did, that wasn't reflected in some of the copy he provided. He consistently suggested the Birmingham Six were guilty, or even worse, they knew who did it, when the police themselves knew who the five people were.
Is there going to be any justice, do you think, in the Birmingham Six case?
Well,
I better rephrase that, hadn't I? Is there going to be any justice in the Birmingham pub bombings case, Chris?
Not while certain senior civil servants are still alive. You see, Sir Philip Knights, who died recently, he took all his secrets to the grave. It's very difficult to find anyone on the police side who was actually involved in that inquiry. I think the only one I can think of is Tommy Methven, who was then head of Special Branch.
And what about coverage of modern terrorism? I mean, this is the thing: is what we need to know is that the criminal justice system is working, and that the media is impartially reporting these attacks rather than just telling them, the public, everything the police want them to.
The media do not have the journalists to cover cases. If you go to every Crown Court in the country, that's in cities and counties and county towns, there are major cases happening there every week which are never reported, other than perhaps one paragraph of what the verdict was. You know, there just simply aren't the staff. There's too many publishers have assumed that online was going to be a license to print money, when in fact just the opposite is true. Well, I mean, if all the newspapers stopped producing, giving away online stories for next to nothing, and that means more people would buy newspapers. That means you'd have more staff available to actually cover these stories.
Now the police will say. The miscarriage of justice, 17 years in jail for six innocent men at the Birmingham Six, could never happen again, Chris.
And pigs might fly. The problem today is a lot of coppers, most senior officers do not come through the ranks. They've only had 2 years on the beat before they become, with the graduate intake, they have to do 2 years on the beat and they're given their stripes. Then you've got to do that for another 2 years before they get their first pip. And they can't be sacked until they've reached inspector. So that means they're going to be there 5 years. And all these people do not know what's going on. They don't know how to speak to ordinary people. They don't know how to get the best out of witnesses. They're very good at giving you the theory, but a lot of them are just not up to the job.
So do you think that something like the Birmingham Six could happen again still?
Yes, I think it could do, but it probably would not be with the Irish Republican side. The majority of people in Northern Ireland want the Good Friday Agreement to work.
That was former Coventry Journal reporter Chris Hewitt, talking about the 1974 stint he did reporting on the Birmingham pub bombings, where 182 were injured and 21 killed. In contrast to the bomb attack by the IRA the month after, in December 1974, here in Bristol, where only two were injured and none were killed. Obviously, the telephoned warnings being absolutely crucial.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Alan Cheshire. I live in the sleepy coastal town of Sunny Cleethorpes on the East Coast. I was brought up on a council estate, and I went to a secondary modern school. I had an older brother, Terry, who was in the Army Royal Engineers and was killed. This had an effect on me, and I joined the Army Cadets.
Can I ask you where Terry was killed?
He was actually killed in a road accident coming home on leave. He'd hitchhiked back down on a fish wagon back down to, I think, Cove. And there was a road accident, and Terry was killed in that road accident. I was very young at that stage, and I didn't really know what was going on. It's only as I got older I realised. So I joined the Army Cadets. I liked the Army Cadets. I liked the discipline. I enjoyed going away. So I joined. There wasn't a lot more for me. I could go to sea, or I could become a joiner. I decided I want to be a soldier. I didn't want to be a Royal Engineer. I didn't want to be a signaller. I wanted to be a fighting soldier. So I joined the Brigade of Guards at Pirbright.
Now, the Guards have got a bit of a reputation as one of the elite regiments, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and I mean, seriously, discipline was unbelievable, especially at 15. And I joined one of the mounted regiments, the Blues and Royals. But it was extremely hard, very, very disciplined. And I am a rebel at the best of times. I was always in getting put on report, doing extras or being locked up. But I persevered and passed into C Squadron, the Blues and Royals.
Can you just give us an idea of the sort of basic training? Because I imagine the Guards, it could be pretty harsh.
Yeah, at that stage, you was as a junior soldier, you were at 15 years old. You had every Sunday was what we call shining parade. So from 8 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, all you did was clean your gear, clean your kit. We had weapon training every day. You had drill every day. The discipline and room inspections were horrendous. In fact, a lot of the times, I never slept in the bed. I slept on the floor so that I could make my bed, put it into bedding blocks, have the locker perfect, have everything. And I slept on the floor, many of us did.
We think of your senior officers coming in very, very early in the morning and expecting everybody who was fast asleep to be up and ready and at attention within a matter of seconds.
Yeah, but it wasn't the officers. In my case, we have what is called cobble of horses. And we don't have sergeants in the Blues and Royals. We have cobble of horses. But you would have lance sergeants, and I had lance sergeants from the Coldstream Guards, the Irish Guards, and the Welsh Guards.
Okay, so these are the NCOs. They're not actually officers. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're the NCOs. They're your platoon corporals up to your sergeants. But your platoon corporal or your trained soldier, he was the guy that got you out of bed and showed you how to wash and shave and do everything else.
And what about the punishments? There must have been, that's bound to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, I had a few punches in the head a few times, but they would give you what is called extras and show again. So you might have to show your kit again and again and again until it was right. And then in my case, they would put you on company orders and everything else, you'd get fined. It was extremely hard.
And so were you relieved when you passed out?
I actually, I found it, believe it or not, I enjoyed the physical side of it. I found, because I was quite a fit guy compared to the others, I didn't smoke. That was a big thing. I found it quite easy towards the end. And going to the Blues and Royals, they were based in Windsor, was a doddle. It was great. I ended up winning the cross-country run at in Windsor Great Park. I refused to bow to, I think it was Princess Anne. I think she was presenting the cup. And I was told I had to bow, and I refused to bow. I got sanctioned for that. And then a company called the Guards Parachute Company. They're the pathfinders of the 16th Parachute Brigade. I was advised by the Blues and Royals to either get out, transfer, or go for the paras.
Was that for upsetting Princess Anne?
Well, that was upsetting Princess Anne and punching a couple of NCOs.
Ah, so they didn't totally knock out the rebel from you?
No, never. No, I joined the army to be a soldier, and the best thing in the Brigade of Guards was the parachute company, and they're the pathfinders for the 16th Parachute Brigade.
And did you find that you know, you had to respect the senior officers and things like that? Because one does wonder if what it's like having all that discipline and then to be put in the charge of somebody who maybe you don't have a lot of respect for.
I found some very, very good Guards officers. I mean, some really, really good officers. I also met some very poor officers. And to this day, I think they must be buying the commission. But generally, they were very good officers. And when you get into a specialised unit like the Paras, you know, nobody gets through P Company if you're not good. And especially if you're an officer. You know, you lead by example.
So you were jumping out of planes by this time?
Yeah. I went to Abingdon. I did P Company, then went to a place called Abingdon, did my static line jumping, got my wings, and served in the Paras until my company got disbanded. The problem is, the company got disbanded and 80% of that company went into G Squadron, the Special Air Service. G Squadron is the Guard Squadron. I didn't think at that time I was ready for that. I was in love, you know, and you know what it's like. I decided to get out. So I left the British Army.
So, but by this time, whereabouts had you been posted? You must have been one of those who went to Northern Ireland, surely.
Yeah, I did. I went to Londonderry, Derry, in Fort George. I did that with the Blues and Royals. And that was, we did the Chantella and all around that area. We were doing the VCPs on the border. And it was quite an interesting time.
Well, Derry was actually one of the more nationalist areas, wasn't it? And probably yeah, Republican areas to be posted
of
to.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, you've got the Bogside, the Cregan, and then, you know, the Chantella was a big council estate, which was, again, highly Republic. It was quite an interesting tour.
Well, I mean, there's even talk now of the Dirty War, actually, in Northern Ireland, and attempts to get some soldiers prosecuted, and also a lot of people complaining that some of the people who were the key IRA bombers, etc., have been given, you know, free passes, get-out-of-jail-free cards.
Yeah, but to be honest, you know, if I don't have sympathy with people who do, we were trained. We were disciplined. And if we did wrong, you do the crime. I don't care who you are. We're not a ragtag army. We're the British Army. We are based on discipline. And I know the situations where you get split-second decisions. I know that. But this is why, in the case of the Brigade of Guards, you are that disciplined. And I personally think if allowing some of these Republican murdering
people to survive, to go free, and we've kept the peace for so long, I think it's worth it.
And that's what the Good Friday Agreement was based on, wasn't it? We value the peace more than digging up one side and the other, because, of course, there were crimes on both sides. It certainly wasn't a one-sided
exactly.
thing. Yeah.
You know, you have units called 14 Company in the British Army, and they weren't angels. They did things. So there's never heroes. There's never the good side in wars. So, to me, the Good Friday Agreement is the main thing. It's brought Ireland, Northern Ireland, out of the troubles so far. But as you know and I know, underneath the surface, there is still problems in Northern Ireland.
Okay, so where else were you posted?
Canada.
Really?
I was an outward bound instructor in Canada. I was in a place called Battis, and that's near Medicine Hat. So once the battle group had finished, we had 6 weeks adventure training. Well, I was a senior army canoeing instructor, so I was doing the river trips down Saskatchewan River, which was great for me. 2 weeks at a time going down a really exciting river.
So this is the idea, really, of Outward Bound is to give young people some sort of experience of a bit of a tough wild life.
Yeah, the whole idea of an Outward Bound course is, as a 12-year-old, I went to a place called Eskdale in the Lake District as a school project, giving me an insight into walking, giving me an insight into climbing, helped me, you know, in the army. And it also broadened my outlook on life, thinking there was more to life than just Sonny Grimsby and Cleethorpes, and Eskdale in the Lake District, sleeping in a tent, getting up, having to swim in the lake in the morning, was a great start. I suggest every young kid goes on one of these.
I mean, actually, a lot of young people, they don't get this. I mean, some people say also that there should be national service. What do you think about that?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The thing is about guys like us, we all volunteer to be in the army. You know, if we was on the streets and the riots in Derry and the other places, being dustbin drivers, being firemen, we all volunteered. The only person we can blame is ourselves. You conscript me. I do not want a conscript next to me in a riot. I do not want a conscript in a tank with me. I want guys like me who volunteered. Nobody forced me to do anything. Nobody forced me into the army. And that's the good thing about our army. No conscripts.
There's a lot of camaraderie, supposedly. And, of course, whoever you're working with, you want to have some camaraderie. But I think maybe because people are desperate for work nowadays, it's actually quite difficult to hold down a job. And even then, you'll find quite often, you know, you're on a rolling contract or something, you could be sacked at any time.
You know,
it's that working environment, whatever it is you're doing, is quite important, isn't it? And the way you're interacting with your colleagues.
Yeah, I agree. This thing about zero contracts, you know, is utter rubbish. Most of the young kids here are on zero contract working in the fish factory. They can, next door neighbour but one, his lad bikes down to a factory 4 miles away, gets there at 6 o'clock, no work for him. It is horrendous for these young kids.
There's something almost medieval about that, isn't it? The old hiring fair, you know, where you go down and some people just don't get any work.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, what I would suggest is that you form some kind of, not the Peace Corps, but a corps that they spend a couple of years in. They learn a trade. It's not a military, it's a course. They do it for 2 years. They do social work. They do, building walls, building pathways in the National Forest. They learn something, but they get the chance to have discipline, 3 meals a day, a concrete basis to their lives, but don't make them into soldiers. encourage them to join the army and do all this, but don't have a conscript army.
It's also very different, the sort of culture of public service and the sort of, you know, commercial, get money grabbing, go getting. You know, I'm afraid a little bit more pro the public service ethos.
Yeah, but what I would go for would be get as close as you can, have run a course where they're doing sports, they're doing team work, they're doing initiative tests, so they get the team spirit, so they get this working ethos as a team, to always look after your mates, to always stick together. Now, I'm not saying make them into a commercial venture, but I'm saying let them do time and improve the social background to their communities.
Now, I know you also spent some time in the Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia conflict, but was that in the army or not?
No, I was with the UNHCR. I worked directly for the British Army out of Vitesse.
Okay, so that's the United Nations...
United Nations High Commission for Refugees. So what happened was I worked with Bob Stewart, Colonel Bob Stewart, the Cheshire Regiment. That was the first regiment into Bosnia. And we was like the carrot. So what happens is when they went into a... If the British Army went into a village and we dealt with baby food, gluten-free food, and tampaxes, you know, for women, sanitary towels. So we would take, and I used to drive in a big Ford 4x4 transit van, no weapons, no armour, nothing. And I used to follow the tanks in, or they used to escort us in, and we was like the carrot. And we worked very well. The secret of that there was I was the only ex-soldier. So when the army did certain things, I could explain to the aid workers why they were doing it, why the army were doing this, why the army were doing that. So having a guy with me, they had a kind of liaison officer. And you know,
so why do you need a tank escort for a truckload of tampaxes?
The reason why is because we would go into a Chetnik area, we would then go into a Hoss area, we would then go into a Mujahideen area. If these areas, there were enclaves, to get into these places, you needed an escort. So the army would escort us into that place.
Well, sometimes, didn't they just say, no, you can't come in, sorry, go away?
Well, no, not with the warrior tanks pointing at them. 99.9% of the time, with the British Army, they could screw about with the other ones, Dutch Bat and everybody else, but they knew the Brit Bat, the British Army, they let us through. And especially with an officer and officers from the Cheshire Regiment. They were very, very tough men.
Okay, so, I mean, you're talking about the carrot here, but, I mean, that almost implies that you were in there first. Once, you know, the locals had relaxed their guard a little bit, the stick would come along.
Yeah. You know, once I went in with an interpreter, and she would deal with the women, and I would have a guy, and they would say to us, well, they need... not only Tampax, they want air shampoo, toothpaste, nappies, and specialised medicine, specialised food. So we then, basically, we were doing hearts and minds. The next time, we used to get resupplied from Reading. The truck used to come down, and then we used to go load up from Split, drive to Vitesse, and then we distribute all the aid to the villages. But once we was in. Like, you know, everybody liked us.
So what do you, now looking back on it, make of the whole Yugoslav conflict? Was it in any way deliberately started? Because this was an interesting part of the world. It was a sort of halfway house between the hardcore communism of the Soviet Union and the commercial way of the West.
Yeah, well, you had Tito. And the thing is, while Tito was alive... it was okay. Once he died, and remember, Tito played the Russians against the West and the West against the Russians. I would never play cards with Tito. But the problem was, once Germany recognised Croatia as an independent country, it hit the fan. Because then it brought back all the Second World War problems and the revenge. You've got to remember, in Mostar, the Germans had a Muslim division, SS. And so, it's like Albania, these people never forget. And this is what happened. One minute they were living next door to each other, next minute they were killing each other.
It's rather frightening to think that something like that can happen. I mean, how do you, looking back on it as well now, how do you think it all ended up? Do you think it was a reasonable solution to it all?
No. No matter where we've served in the world, where the UN have been, be it Belize, be it Bosnia, be it Sierra Leone, we've never brought peace.
Well, hang on. Right. Sierra Leone and Rwanda, places like that, are talked of as great successes of the army.
Well, you're saying so, but remember, Rwanda and Srebrenica were the two major things that were, back in the 1980s, I thought we had a chance of international, you know, liberalism. But with them two incidents, it was over. And we've still got problems in these countries. It's called, everybody says, you know, it's peace. But take Northern Ireland, take Bosnia. I was back in Bosnia 18 months ago, and it's just bubbling under the surface. So our intervention helped at the time, but I don't think we've given them full long-term peace.
But how does your experience, what has it taught you about how power really works?
Politics. I'm always on the ground at the sharp end. But things, you know, politicians, things that are beyond my capabilities. I'm the guy on the ground. I don't look at the big picture. All I look at is one family, one house, one village. And that's the limit of my... It's too big. The big picture would be too big for a guy like me. But there's always, always something happening. You know, backdoor, sneaky, beaky. There's always been this, and there always will be.
So do you think whatever the mission is, it gets sort of lost up the chain of command somewhere?
Yeah, it does. Because you've got a shiny arse sat in a control room and dictating or telling you what you should do instead of listening to the guy on the ground. By the time it's gone up the chain of command, the situation has moved. You've got to, in these situations I find myself, you've got to flow in front. It's changing all the time, and you've got to be able to move. But, you know, maybe now the army, they've got the communications and everything else, and you've got these drones, fine. But back in the 1980s, it was the old school, you know, and by the time you'd got permission to move to that one, you had another problem, you had another situation.
I mean, some say that the drones are there particularly because sometimes it's impossible to get the soldiers themselves, because the soldiers can't stomach some of the... I mean, we're talking about killing here. You know, sometimes that's what soldiers are there to do. You're not a policeman, you're a soldier. And the drones are a way, apparently, of taking the kind of morals out of whatever war we're fighting, the next one.
Yeah, well, again, you know, you take the Queen's shilling, you pay the Queen's price, and some of the price is actually doing the Queen's business. And that is killing people. You are a soldier. You're not there to do, you know, you are a soldier. The thing is with drones, I've been on the receiving end of drones in Pakistan. And, you know, drones are a very, very sticky subject with me. Because...
So what was your experience there? This Pakistan is known, is it, as a place where, you know, the West has been using drones basically to assassinate people.
Yeah, well, you've also got to remember that the Pakistani government themselves have been flying drones into a place called Swat Valley, and that was a big Taliban area. But it's not only that, you know, you've got a drone commander and some in the bellies of a destroyer in the Persian Gulf controlling a drone. Now, that young technician, is doing the best he can to hit a designated target without collateral damage. But when I was in Pakistan and they were going on about the drones, I mentioned to a certain mullah saying that, well, what about your drones? And he said, we have got no drones. And I say, of course you've got a drone. Your drone's a suicide bomber. And what that is, he's controlled by a mullah in some cave in the northwest frontier. But when he hits a target, he doesn't care about collateral damage. He wants to kill as many people as he can, or she can.
Okay, there is a confusion here, though, because sometimes, I mean, I remember reading about one of the big attacks in Baghdad just after the start of the illegal invasion of Iraq, and that was where it was said that it was a suicide bomber at a bus stop that had blown everyone up. But in the local newspaper, they said, well, no, all the eyewitnesses, and of course that story goes all the way around the world within a few minutes, you know, and the eyewitnesses all said that, no, it was a drone, it was a missile that came down and hit the bus queue, and that went into the Iraqi Baghdad newspaper, and the next day, yeah, Paul Bremer and his fellas came and shut the newspaper down. So I think we can work out what actually happened. So what's your take on the way that the press deals with these conflicts, particularly ones you've been involved in?
The press, it's all propaganda, all right? It's propaganda for one side. Like you've just mentioned that could be, if you like, propaganda on one side. I've worked in Pakistan, where there's no free press, where there's nothing. You know, anybody with a voice, reporting-wise, has been killed, been assassinated. So the press, and now you've got the internet and Facebook and all this false news, you're suddenly realising how powerful this thing is, which is the press, to change people's conception of the truth. But like the Arabs say, inshallah, who, what truth? Unless you were there on the ground, we don't know. You don't know that a drone hit that crowd. So, like I say, it's all propaganda.
And spin. Anyway, look, I mean, I know you have some, you know, quite regrets about what happened in Yugoslavia. How have you dealt with that?
I was in Srebrenica. I delivered aid to Srebrenica. The main thing that wound me up was the Dutch bat. And they're the Dutch conscript soldiers who were right-wing fascists. And I'll tell you the reason why. I was in a place called Vitez, and I was knocked out of bed by a woman, and I had to go to a place called Kisiak. Her son was an electrician. He'd been working in the Dutch bat's compound. At 10 o'clock at night, they threw him out of the camp. When I got there with his mother, we had to hold the mother in the Land Rover, and I picked the body up of their son. He'd been tortured by the HOS, the Croatian paramilitaries. So this is the thing that got me. And we knew these areas were going to be hit. But once the heavy weapons came into a place called Tuzla, if you look on a map on the northern part of Bosnia, you'll have an airfield called Tuzla. And the ISI, you know what the ISI is? That's the Inter-Service Intelligence from Pakistan. They broke the UN arms embargo and flew in heavy weapons. Once them heavy weapons came to the Muslims, it hit the fan and Srebrenica started.
But I mean, I imagine the ISI would say, well, the Muslims, Bosnian Muslims, needed to defend themselves.
Yeah, but this world of fantasy that any time the Yugoslavia army wanted to walk through Bosnia, they could have done it. They could have brought in the whole of the Yugoslavia army. They would have walked all the way through to Mostar. You know, the best way was out what was happening. The peace process was starting, but no, they had to do this. And this is what upset me. This is why I needed redemption from Bosnia, and that's why I went to Pakistan. I went to Pakistan to help the Baluch, because I'm actually a water engineer. I can clean water. So my naive way of thinking is I'll go to where's the worst place I can go to? And it was Pakistan. I actually flew into Lahore 2 days after Musharraf had done the military coup. And I was at Manchester Airport, and the diplomatic, you know, all these shiny arses from the diplomatic corps were telling us not to go to Pakistan. There's a coup and they're expecting bloodshed. Luckily, there was no bloodshed this time. That was the fourth coup that they'd had. And that's really why I went to Pakistan, A, to learn the language and to understand more of the culture.
Well, what do you make then of, because this has been the big feature, really, of the 21st century, is this whole thing of Islamic terrorism, fundamentalism. Although, of course, you know, here in Bristol and in other cities around Britain, most of the Muslims we meet are not interested in any of this stuff, but yet it seems to be big on our TV screens.
Yeah, it's... You've got to understand, let's get this right. I've just given a lecture on slavery within Islam, and that's a subject that's taboo in Islam. They don't like discussing slavery. But let's get this right. There's more Jedi Knights on the registration, on the voting registration, you know, label, the voting table, Jedi Knights than there are Muslims. All right? You've got to understand that a young Muslim kid is torn between sex, drugs and rock and roll and their Islamic ways. So what
well,
they
just,
do...
That sounds exactly like the UK, doesn't it?
It is. You know, they used to fly me back from Bosnia to go to a place called Gorton in Manchester. And I was trying to convince young Muslim lads not to join jihad. Now, you see, what the problem is this word jihad. You see, what do you think jihad means?
Well, it's some sort of holy war, isn't it?
Don't know. All jihad means is struggle. Okay? Now, there are two types of jihad. The greater jihad and the lesser jihad. The greater jihad is for a Muslim to follow the way of their prophet, Muhammad. The lesser jihad is the defense of the Ummah. Do you know what the Ummah is? The Ummah is the international brotherhood, sisterhood of the Muslim world. So they can go on jihad in Bosnia, in my case, or into Syria to protect. And that's it. And the main problem with Muslims and Islam today is a thing called the Hadith. Do you know what the Hadith is? No. The Hadith is a set of rules and ways written 200 years after the death of the Prophet. Now, what happens, like all religions, they cherry pick. And the Hadith has become such a thing, what is called Chinese whispers. And that's where all these lunatics interpret, take, cherry pick. And that is your problem. When I was in Pakistan, let's just go Punjab. There were 30,000 madrasas. These madrasas are not controlled. They're sponsored by the Saudis. The Saudis are... Their form of Islam is called Wahhabists. They're Wahhabists. Right wing. Very extreme. But these madrasas were out of control. There was no rules. They were just taught the evil way of the bad side of Islam, like all religions. There's good and the bad. And this is the problem. It's lack of education. Same problem here in the UK. Unlicensed schools. So, you know, it's quite a mess.
If you could bend the ear of the Chief of the General Staff, what advice do you think you'd have for him to, as someone who's served in the British Army, for the future? Yeah. Because obviously war has not disappeared from our planet.
Yeah, I tell you what, I can only concentrate on Pakistan because of the 10 years I've been there. First of all, I would stop giving them aid. Stop. I would turn that aid into trade. So I'd lift the barriers on international trade, and there's quite a few in Pakistan, but stop giving them £70 million a year. In 10 years of working on the ground in them villages, I saw no British aid at anywhere. Oh, sorry, I saw a double-decker bus full of books roaming round Lahore. I've seen a puppet show. But on the ground, nothing. Now, the God Squad, the sisters and the monks, they're on the ground, they're teaching, you know, education. But you've got to put rules. You've got to stop doing this. When we give money to Pakistan, 70% of it goes to the army. 70%. 10% goes to the politicians. The rest might go to the people. The best one the British government ever did was give them, you know, one of these debit cards for the machines. So there was no cash. They just put it in the bank. So I sat there in a place called Multan, and my driver said to me, Chacha, his uncle, they call me uncle, Chacha, watch this. And I saw these guys from the PPP, Pakistan People's Party. They went to an house, picked the guy up, took him to the cash machine, he drew the money out, they took 30% and kept the rest. This is lack of people on the ground. You want people on the ground. But they were saying it was too dangerous. Well, I did 10 years there, mate. And the Pakistan people themselves are so friendly, they're unbelievable. But they've been let down time and time again by the government.
Well, I mean, Imran Khan is trying to change a bit of that. And a lot of people say...
Get out of it. Get away. Listen, mate. He was destined to be the next prime minister. I know from 5 years ago. I've got the pictures to prove it. He supported the Taliban. Okay? He is not what... He's the great saviour of Pakistan. He's not. You know?
What about Kashmir? Because that's a much more serious issue with the Indians moving in there.
That is a problem, again, caused by the British, the two states. Pakistan has got no legal right to Kashmir. No legal right. That is done by the UN.
But, I mean, a lot of the Kashmiris say they want to be with Pakistan. If they were to have a vote there, they'd go for it, but they've never been allowed to have it.
Well, no. I know Kashmiris. I've never been to Kashmir because they wouldn't let me go, but I know a lot of Kashmiris, and Kashmiris want Kashmir for themselves. They don't want Pakistan. They don't want India. Remember what happened in Kashmir? The ISI trained terrorist groups to attack India. This is why India is kicking off, because of the terrorist groups that are leaving Kashmir and attacking India.
So do you think we Brits left that deliberately, like, you know, as a problem for the future when we pulled out?
No. I don't think, and I know we've got a past of being dumbasses, but
it's a divide and rule tactic, surely.
Yeah, of course it's divide and rule. But you have, you know, I don't think when once we left, and it was like, wham, bam, thank you, man, we're out of here, they didn't understand the repercussions of what would happen. And Kashmir and the millions killed after partition, or just straight after partition. And you remember this Durran line in Pakistan. There isn't such a thing. In that area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's a no-man's land. Nobody knows where the border is. That is, again, a screw-up by the British.
So, I mean, where do you see, with all your experience of these various on various sides of the wars, civilian and in uniform, where do you see things heading at the moment?
Well, I think, see things heading, I think we must, you must talk to the Taliban. Because let me explain why. Not all Taliban are lunatics. I've met many, many Taliban, and they, you know, they're very, very pious men, and they have their way of life. But they've, unless we talk to them, and there are some moderates, get them, give them a choice. We can either carry on doing this, or we can have peace. Give them peace.
So what are we doing in what are we doing in Afghanistan? There's another question for you. What are we doing there?
I have no idea, mate. You know, you've got to, you must think back, you know, what you don't know, and or maybe you do know, but the, you know, Afghanistan is, they're being interfered by the Indians, by the Pakistanis, and more and more by the Russians. Now, you might think that the Russians aren't involved in Afghanistan. They are. This is called payback. So what they're doing, they're arming them groups. The Russians are arming them. Do you know why? To get payback for what the British and what we did when they was in Afghanistan. And I know that for a fact, because two of the guys who I give water to in Lahore, they were from that area. They came out of there because of the Russian weapons being given to the Taliban. So everybody's, leave it alone. Get them, sit them down the table and get them working. Get them talking. Because we're just going to lose. Even if you put 100,000 troops into Afghanistan, you wouldn't have beaten them. You might have contained them. Because they've been fighting hundreds of years. It's what they do.
So finally, for any youngsters listening, thinking, well, maybe of joining the army, particularly if it's difficult to get work these days in Bristol, what advice would you have for them?
What advice? Don't join at 15. Do not join as a junior soldier. I'm totally against junior service. I would say, when you're 15, go out, get drunk, have a fight, fall in love, fall out of love, you know, just have some fun. 18, reevaluate your life, and if you think, well, I've got to do something, then do it. But do not join at 15. You'll end up like me.
Alan Cheshire, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. Download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Chris Ewart and Alan Cheshire, also to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. If you have some of your precious time to spare, why not volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. So, thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, Goodbye for now.